Here's David Krakauer. He's an internationally known scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he delivered a series of lectures on the evolution of intelligence on Earth. I asked him about the nature of intelligence and how definitions of what we call intelligence have been used to separate groups from each other.
Well, typically it had to do with A, elevating the status of humanity above the rest of animate life. And so humans, unlike the rest of the beasts, have souls and they have reason and consequently should be given preferential and privileged status. And that, of course, was extended to other members of our own species.
I was going to say some... Perhaps the British are better than the Africans, savages, or things like that?
Exactly. And so, well, that's exactly right. And so that tendency really emerged in the 18th century. And so, and all sorts of stupid pseudoscientific theories, anthropometry, physiognomy, craniometry, the cephalic index, all these big words that gave a scientific gloss to what was essentially racism. And the IQ test, and here, you know, the SAT test and so forth, grew out, actually, of those early psychometric tradition, the early attempt to give a number to what was essentially a prejudice.
I was wondering whether intelligence is, if not synonymous with life itself, but integral to life itself, because if anybody survived the hundreds of millions or billions of years that life has been, how long has life been on Earth? 3-4 billion years?
Yes.
If anyone survived that long, they must have something going for
them. Well, actually, it's interesting you say that, because I think that the prototypical theory of intelligence that might surprise people is Darwin's theory. If you look at intelligence definitions, either they're stupid, so that which is measured by an intelligence test, right, or cryptic, the capacity to acquire capacities. In fact, most of them are things like the ability to behave flexibly, the ability to adapt to changing circumstance. And those are all, if you think about it, evolutionary perspectives. And so, in fact, I'll actually show that when Darwin created his theory of evolution, without him knowing it, he was actually creating the first real theory of intelligence.
Now, there are people who say dolphins are intelligent, or my terrier is intelligent, or my four-year-old is intelligent. Mm-hmm. Do those statements have anything in common?
I think they have a ton in common. Without defining it, you can ask, what are its essential ingredients? Animals solve difficult problems all the time. Moving around a room, for example, right, is a very hard problem. If you've ever seen a robot that tries to navigate a crowded room, you'll understand how difficult it is. It's much harder than chess, for example, that computers effortlessly beat us at.
What role does creativity play? In other words, where do you put creativity in the whole context of intelligence? To me, it seems like a really major part of the whole picture.
It is, and it's completely unsolved. It's something I struggled with, and so everyone recognizes it when they see it as somehow what Charles Peirce called abduction. That is the formulation of a genuinely new idea, right? Not just solving an idea someone else gave you. There is no theory, I think it's fair to say, that we have that can explain how new ideas come into existence.
Laurie Santos is a professor of psychology at Yale University and studies capuchin monkeys, exploring, among other things, their buying and selling, essentially market-based behavior.
You actually taught them to use currency. You gave them little coins and taught them to basically, I don't know about sell, but to buy their food.
That's right. And the shocking thing about this work is when we got into it, we just sort of asked, you know, can we get monkeys to do this? What we were really impressed by is how quickly they were able to do it. So the monkeys picked up that, so we introduced monkeys to these little metal washers. They kind of look like little quarters, and just trained them that they can use them to pay for food from human experimenters.
How did you do this? I mean, how do you communicate with them?
With the tokens was just to give them the tokens and have a human experimenter standing there who's kind of holding a nice piece of food that the monkeys want. And they're curious creatures, right? So they'll pick up the tokens and kind of investigate them. And then, you know, a savvy experimenter can kind of sort of force them to do a quick swap with the token and, you know, grab the token and hand over the food. And really as quickly as that, they pick this up, like, aha, these tokens can be traded for food.
What kind of social or cultural differences do you have between one group of capuchin monkeys in one place and in another place? Maybe one's in a laboratory, one's in the wild.
Yeah, it's a great question, and actually one that's relatively understudied. Often when you work with these groups of animals, there are only small numbers of individuals, so it's often hard to compare whether the noise you're seeing and the differences are really big differences across cultures or actually differences, you know, just in the idiosyncrasies of the individuals you work with. But those who work with wild populations have actually seen really interesting cultural differences across different groups of primates that have been studied, particularly chimpanzees, where you see different tool use traditions, different kinds of social traditions across the different populations. One of the neat things about that work is it seems like those differences aren't due to just ecological differences. So in other words, it's not just that one group doesn't use a tool because they don't have access to those materials. The differences, as far as we can tell, seem to be richly cultural for these apes that folks are studying.
So basically, somebody figures something out and they pass it on, and just like in human culture,
That grows and develops. Yeah, and so one of the questions is why you don't, the psychologists refer to this phenomena of ratcheting. So you get more and more and more technological innovation over time. Other animals, particularly other apes, seem to have this. The question is why it doesn't ratchet as far as it does, of course, in human cultures where, you know, no other species on the planet is, you know, doing what we're doing right now, talking to each other, you know, none of them are doing what your listeners are doing, which is using technology to kind of hear other people that they can't see. You know, so the question of why other species never get to that point is actually a very interesting one, and one for which we don't have a great answer yet.
So how far have you gotten with studying that
with these kinds of questions? Yeah. So primate researchers have actually figured out a couple interesting things. One is it seems like humans, more so than other primates, are really slaves to watching others act. So there's a set of studies, both with human children and with chimpanzees, where you give these populations some tool that they can't figure out. So it's usually kind of some opaque puzzle box that they have to use a tool to open. And because of the opaque nature of the box, it's not easy to figure out how this thing works. And what you find is that in that case, both chimpanzees and young human children will imitate the actions that they see others take, which is a smart strategy because if you don't know how it works, watching the way others act is pretty good. But now you mix it up a bit. Now you give chimpanzees and children the same puzzle box, but the whole box is clear. So now it's really obvious how it works. And what both of these populations can see is that you actually don't need to use the tool in the way that this actor is using the tool. So you see someone act on this box and you realize they're acting in a really stupid way that doesn't matter for actually operating the box. What you see with chimpanzees, when they get to use the box, they just use what they know and figure it out. They ignore completely what the person does. But human children, interestingly, do something else. They actually slavishly copy what they see another person do, even though they can articulate to you that it's a stupid way of going about doing something. So the claim is it seems like there's something about humans that really takes into account what other people are doing, almost in a very slavish way, where we can't avoid copying others. You know, this is stupid in the context of, you know, the experiments that we set up, which make, you know, human children.
Yeah,
in this
it
case,
makes chimpanzees look smarter than their
than
human
kids.
Counterparts.
Yeah, I mean, but oftentimes where we find ourselves imitating is in cases where, you know, we might not know how things work and so on. You know, probably none of us would be able to figure out, you know, how an iPhone or a computer or a car worked if we didn't have lots of people showing us. You know, we live in a causal world that's way more complex than other species have.
We think of ourselves as the most rational animal, but what you're saying would indicate that we're highly irrational in that we look to the social group more than we look to the phenomenon at hand.
Yeah, I mean, in so many different contexts, what we're learning is that, you know, humans aren't as smart as we think. We often use these really quick rules of thumb, whether it be watching someone else or paying, just using some sort of quick and dirty strategy. I think the most ironic thing is that not just that we use these strategies, is that we refuse to believe that we're irrational. We like to think of ourselves as, you know, kind of maximally smart and maximally rational and flexible. And when you actually do the right studies, it seems like we might not be. You know, embarrassingly, we might be worse than other animals sometimes in this regard as well.
Daniel Dennett is co-director of cognitive studies at Tufts University. He's professor of philosophy there. He's a well-known atheist. And oddly enough, he studies religion, but in a scientific way.
How do you define religion?
Oh, I was afraid you were going to ask me that question. I define religions as social systems whose participants avow a belief in a supernatural agent or agents whose approval is to be sought. This distinguishes religion from other kinds of superstition, you know, black magic. And the word avow is important, too, because I think that it's not so much that people believe in these gods as that they avow in a belief in them.
What does that mean?
It means that they behave as if they believed in these supernatural agents or supernatural agent, but they may not, and a lot of them don't. In fact, my hunch is that a surprisingly large percentage of contemporary, for instance, Christians, don't actually believe in the God that they avow a belief in. They believe in belief and don't actually, when push comes to shove, believe in the deity that they say they do.
And so what are some of the reasons why they say they do or they believe in belief?
Because they think, and with some pretty good reason, that the social fabric depends on people believing in God. They're very afraid that if the world became atheistic, the world would go to hell in a handbasket, that things would be very, very bad, that morality would dissolve. I think that's a mistake. I'm sure it's a mistake. But it's not an obvious mistake. And I understand why people are so anxious about the question.
Your definition of religion includes this concept of social systems. And as we were talking about, being part of a social system that brings people together and holds communities together is a very important function of religion. How well do you think it works?
Sometimes it works wonderfully. I think we have to acknowledge that for what you might call moral teamwork, religious organizations just hold the record. They do the best job of enlisting people with a very strong sense of loyalty to make major sacrifices to accomplish ends. Not always good ends. If what you want is teamwork of a large social group, religion is the kind of institution that does that best.
What does the scientific study of religion look like?
Well, if we're going to treat religion as a natural phenomenon, then we're going to consider it from the point of view of the social sciences, from the point of view of history, archaeology, but also of biology. It is, in an important sense, a biological phenomenon, in the same way that, say, language or music are biological phenomena, too. They are ubiquitous. They seem to be deeply rooted in human nature. And many of their features clearly are not artifacts made deliberately by human beings. That puts them on the side of biology.
How do you actually study that?
You reverse engineer the religions that you find, and you, like a good evolutionary biologist, you look at history and at the sort of fossil traces as best you can. We know that today's religions descended from earlier religions. We know that history going back several thousand years pretty well. Beyond that, things get pretty murky, but we have every reason to believe that there were what I called wild religions before there were organized religions, before there were bishops and priests, before there were imams, before there were seminaries and, as it were, official versions of sacred texts. There were earlier forms of religion. And I think a lot of the features we see in contemporary religions are actually fossil traces of those earlier phenomena. And we can figure them out by seeing what role they would play in the perpetuation of themselves. That is, some of the features of religion that make it a particularly potent, make it particularly powerful organizer of human time and energy seem to have evolved by cultural evolution quite independently of any human attempts to steer it or to invent it. In general, religion isn't invented.
And yet it's co-created by each new generation.
Not only that, but it's extremely effective, efficient. It's brilliantly designed. Now, when we find things that are brilliantly designed, that are not just haphazard, there's only really two natural possibilities. Either some very clever people designed them, or they designed themselves by natural selection.
Like a beehive.
Like a beehive. Like the bird's wing. Like everything in the biosphere. And I think that a lot of the features of religion are best seen as products of cultural evolution, building on genetic evolution.
Albert Migliori is a laboratory fellow at Los Alamos National Laboratory. He's director of the Seaborg Institute National High Magnetic Field Laboratory. He's a condensed matter physicist And here he's talking to us about the great importance of not only clean energy, but energy storage.
Well, the wonderful thing here is that the science problem for us is so clearly defined. We know how to make electricity from wind. We might be refining that over the next decade or two, but we do a really good job of getting electricity from the wind into a bunch of electrical wires. We can do the same with solar. We know how to make electricity from sunlight, either photovoltaics or running a bunch of mirrors and a boiler, but we can do it. But that we have no technology that can store enough energy to take the output, for example, of the wind farms in New Mexico in the spring at night, where we have huge amounts of wind energy, and carry them to August in Albuquerque in the summer when the air conditioning loads go up. That doesn't exist today. That technology is missing.
And it's amazing that it's missing, because all of us have flashlights that have batteries, and we have cell phones that have batteries, and we think that electricity storage is just a given.
Well, just think about the flashlight batteries and the pile of dead batteries you'd have if you tried to use that for grid storage. Even if you have rechargeable batteries, every cubic centimeter of a battery is expensive, as you well know when you try and buy either the regular ones or the rechargeable ones. So even if I make fancy new batteries, you're never going to drive, for example, a semi from Chicago to Los Angeles on batteries. So you're stuck with trying to solve a problem where the costs, the efficiencies, and the energy densities are far, far away from what any battery can do. So what do we do? What do we want to make? Well, you know, there's the popular one of a few years ago of making hydrogen. But hydrogen's really trouble. It's a huge problem is that you can't store it. It's an explosive, flammable gas.
So you don't exactly want it in the back of your car.
Well, especially because in the back of your car, you're going to store it in a storage tank that has 12,000 pounds per square inch of pressure built by the lowest bidder for the automotive industry. You can drive that, but I'm going to bicycle. So we need to have liquid chemicals, and we need to have liquid chemicals that can only be made from electricity. And they have to be chemicals so that once I make them, I can leave them in my storage tank for 20 years, and later I can pull them out and make electricity from those chemicals at reasonable efficiency. So what do we want to make? There's a bunch of choices, but my favorite today, and I'm working very hard at Los Alamos to make this a reality, is to produce ammonia. That's a surprise. But if you think about ammonia, it's the second most produced industrial chemical today, although it's not produced from electricity, so it's not used to store energy. But we have the storage and the distribution networks already in place for ammonia. And ammonia is the most important fertilizer for growing crops. So if I can take a wind farm or a solar thermal plant or anything, even a coal-fired or a gas-fired power plant, and run that energy into making ammonia, then sometime later, after I store it in a big cheap steel tank, I can run it through a fuel cell and make electricity. I can burn it in a diesel engine and make a car or a tractor go. And this was done earlier in the last century. They ran tractors on ammonia because they were pumping it into the ground and they had big storage tanks on their farms anyway, so they used it as diesel fuel. And I can pump it in the ground and grow crops. So I've got a fuel for engines, a chemical for fuel cells, and a fertilizer. It just looks wonderful to me.
And so what's in the way?
What's in the way is we can't make it efficiently. But the cool thing about that is that there isn't a single physical law that says we shouldn't be able to do this. But unfortunately, even though there's 250 years of electrochemistry behind us, it's only recently that the imperative to make something like ammonia from electricity has become critically important, and that the scientific tools that let you look at chemistry right down to the molecular level have become widespread and available. So we're at kind of a revolutionary time at the juncture between chemistry and physics, where we have a shot at studying these processes and understanding them well enough to make them happen at levels that solve large-scale energy storage problems. You know, you might say grid scale, but I don't want to really restrict it to what today we think of as grid scale, because these could be distributed. You're not going to have one in your basement, but you might have one for the whole block.